The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, we'll learn how artificial intelligence is allowing scientists to understand how the brain functions. A new algorithm illuminates the brain's internal connections, and researchers are gaining new insight into the brain's reward system. And we'll take a trip aboard a floating classroom. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Scientists at Weill Cornell Medicine say a new algorithm can help us better understand how complex behavior arises from the brain. The so-called KrakenCoder is a powerful tool that maps anatomical connections in the brain. To learn more about the KrakenCoder, I spoke with Dr. Amy Kusiewski.
Just in the last, let's say, 30 or 35 years, we've been able to do non-invasive imaging of the entire brain at a really high spatial resolution using something called functional MRI. And that measures brain activity, essentially. Really what it measures is the blood flow, which is kind of redirected towards neurons that are active. So you can kind of track that brain flow as a proxy for how the neurons are firing. And so you're sort of brain is made up of two kinds of tissue. There's gray matter and there's white matter. So everybody's probably familiar with gray matter. That's where your neurons live. But there's a second kind of tissue called the white matter, and it's essentially the wiring in the brain. So these kind of large scale bits of tissue that allow different parts of your brain to communicate with one another. So they're bundles of cells, basically, the axons of cells that allow the electrical signals to pass from one part of the brain to the other. And from this kind of orchestrated symphony of brain activity, your behavior arises. So things like feelings, thoughts, emotions, your interaction with your environment. And we're just starting to sort of scratch the surface about how this sort of large-scale networks impact our behavior.
So what are some of the limitations up until now that scientists have encountered when trying to understand the brain through MRI technology and other imaging technology, 3D scans, that sort of thing? Have there been any roadblocks that have prevented us from getting a complete picture as to how the brain communicates?
Yes, yeah, certainly. And there still are those roadblocks, but we're working to try and overcome them so we can better understand how sort of behavior and human interactions arise from the brain. But I would say there are some major limitations to fMRI. One of them, you know, the functional MRI, how we measure brain activity. One of the sort of drawbacks of that is it is measuring an indirect proxy for neural activity, right? So you're measuring blood flow rather than actual neural activity. And this blood flow can change in different disease states or states of arousal. So you're kind of getting an indirect measure of brain activity. And also there's problems when you're in the scanner of people moving. So there's this idea of motion in the scanner can mess with the fMRI signals and make it a little less perfect. And then obviously the sort of resolution at which you can measure brain activity with fMRI is very good compared to other things like EEG. However, it's still, you know, the best we can get is maybe a 1.5 millimeter voxel in the brain, and that contains a multitude of actual neurons. So the scale at which we can measure brain activity is still inadequate for what we actually want to do at the cellular level. And then in terms of diffusion MRI, when we're trying to measure the wiring in the brain, there's lots of different things, including signal to noise ratios that make it difficult to sort of extract the directionality of the fibers that are passing messages along in the brain.
Okay, so now enter KrakenCoder, and this is an algorithm, but maybe you can help explain it a little better than I can. What is this tool, and what does it actually do?
Yeah, so the reason it's called the KrakenCoder is because it's an encoding, an autoencoder. So that's where we get the encoder, and then it has many arms. So that's where we get the Kraken, after the mythical creature. But essentially what it does is there's a big sort of, there's no agreement in our field about how to process these images that we take of brain structure and function. So there's lots of different choices that you can make, including how to divide the brain up into parts, how to process the signals themselves, how to deal with motion and things like I talked about earlier with the signal to noise ratios not being perfect. And so what we decided to do was just take all of the pipelines we could think of, and push them all into this common low dimensional latent space. And so it allows us to take multiple pictures from different points of view and sort of mesh them together to get a low dimensional representation of brain networks.
Aha, and maybe low dimensional is key here. Why are you using the word low dimensional versus a high resolution scan?
Right, so oftentimes we run into this issue where we can only take a picture of people's, only a certain number of people's brains, right? And so the data that we get back, it has a small number of people's pictures of people's brains, but it has a large number of measurements. And so then anytime you wanna map to some kind of dimension, behavioral dimension, let's say age or cognitive score, then you have a lot of input variables. So each person has hundreds of thousands of input variables, and there's only a few observations. So you end up with a very ill-posed problem that doesn't allow you to get a good understanding of the mapping between all of these measurements and these kind of low-dimensional outcomes. So ways to compress the data can allow us to get a better understanding of the mapping between brain and behavior.
So while scientists may know where a certain part of the brain processes certain information, what's less understood is how different areas of the brain actually communicate with each other. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we have a pretty good understanding of specific parts of the brain that map to specific functions. There are these so-called eloquent cortices, and there are things like the motor area and the language area and the visual area that we know have a very specific area, specific location in the brain, and they map to very specific behaviors like movement or sight or language, production and understanding of language. Less is known about the connections between the regions and how they communicate and act in coordination to produce a behavior that's complex. Say something like doing your taxes or speaking to your spouse.
Sure. So now with this crack encoder algorithm and the ability to predict how a brain functions and communicates, and making that more clear than ever before, what are some of the applications? You had mentioned just now somebody who may have suffered a stroke. Where does this sort of technology meet a real-world application?
Yeah, so right now we're working on improving that. So this tool is part of the process in improving the ability to predict some kind of outcome like a cognitive score or a motor score from the brain's connections. And so one of the applications that we have in mind is to be able to apply it to people who've had a brain injury, which is a notoriously hard thing to prognose. And then we could potentially understand better their trajectories of likely recovery and tailor specific treatments to that person to help support their brain in the recovery of the function that they've lost.
And are there any specific areas of where you want to take, you personally want to take this technology next?
Yes. So our next project that we're working on right now is in stroke and multiple sclerosis. And so we have some very promising results showing that you can use sort of clinically acquired imaging. So you don't even need advanced MRI. So you could base this around clinically acquired imaging to create estimates of the functional and structural network disruption that occurs because of a lesion and use that to map to behavior. And the idea would be that eventually, if you have enough data, you have enough variety of input variables, you could potentially use where the lesion is along with the demographics and the other clinical information from a person to personalize a treatment for them specifically.
And Amy, is there anything else that you'd like to add about your research here or what's coming next?
I do want to make sure I emphasize that this work was led by my brilliant staff associate, Keith Jameson, who we've been working for several years now. And he really spearheaded this project. And I really think that this is a good tool for brain behavior mapping, especially when we're dealing with things like multiple sites, So things, you know, if I take a picture of my brain at one site and a picture of my same brain in a different MRI scanner, they can look slightly different. And so we're actually exploring how we can use the crack encoder to get rid of those differences and better create these brain behavior models.
Well, wonderful. And thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Dr. Amy Kusiewski is a professor of mathematics in radiology and in neuroscience at Weill Cornell Medicine. Her research on the crack encoder is published in the journal Nature Methods. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Researchers from McGill University in Canada, Harvard in the United States, and the University of Geneva in Switzerland have used an AI algorithm to help understand the brain's reward system. I spoke with McGill behavioral neuroscientist Paul Massett about his team's research into the brain's main source of dopamine.
What we've been looking at is a part of the midbrain. So it's like quite deep in the brain, and it's called the ventral tegmental area. And it has neurons that release dopamine. And dopamine has been sort of associated with reward. And one of the reasons is that basically when there is reward around, these neurons release dopamine. But sort of the key advance that has happened in, you know, now it was in the 90s, so it's been a few years, is to understand that release of dopamine was not sort of this reward signal directly, but was actually a prediction error, like a prediction error. So it was unexpected reward. And so they were signaling the presence of unexpected reward. And what was very interesting from the point of view of the sort of this interplay between AI and neuroscience is that it was sort of framed and understood as the same signal that you have in what's called reinforcement learning, which is one of the key sort of AI methods. And so they really understood the activity of this neuron and the signal they transmitted, the dopamine signal basically they sent to other brain areas as really capturing the same or something very similar to that temporal, it's called temporal difference error in reinforcement learning, that sort of reward prediction error basically signal. And so that's sort of one of the core ideas behind, I want to say, the field studying these neurons and how the function of dopamine in the areas these neurons project to.
So how was AI actually integrated into this study in examining the VTA and trying to understand more about the brain's reward system and the anticipation of a reward? What did AI allow your team to be able to actually do that we weren't able to before?
Yeah. So one thing is that it allows you to sort of formalize what is the sort of problem that might be solved by a system predicting reward, right? And I want to say this can sound philosophical, but it's a bit, what is reward, right? What is actually reward and what is value? And so the key idea of this error signal, so we're measuring the error signal, but what is the error used for? It's used to learn value. And what is value? Value can be defined, and that's defined sort of across fields from economics to, you know, sort of, behavioral sort of foraging theory and behavior and machine learning as sort of the idea of discounted expected future reward. So being in a certain state might not have, you know, you might not be getting a reward at a given spot, but if that spot leads to a reward in the future, it's valuable to be in that spot, right? And so that's sort of the conceptualization. Okay, so you have a state and you have discounted future value. But the question is, how do you discount the future, right? So something that's further in the future has less value than if it's happening now, right? If someone gives you $100 right now, you prefer that than if they tell you they're going to give you $100 in 2 years, right? Because even if you ignore inflation or anything like that, right, you're not sure you're going to meet them. There's uncertainty and things like this. And so that's where basically thinking about the problem put us to think about what is the time horizon you should discount, right? How far should you look into the future? And so typically in machine learning and sort of in a lot of economics, for example, you think about an exponential discounting rate. You have a single time scale of discounting the future, right? An interest rate, for example, if you have a single interest rate, everything occurs at one rate and at every time interval, you multiply by the same factor. But if you look at behavior on the sort of humans and animals, what you observe is this idea of hyperbolic discounting. So you sort of discount very steeply early on, and then afterwards, stuff in the future is just far away. And there's several observations behaviorally you can see that basically if you ask people this question I was asking you, do you want $100 now or $100 tomorrow? Like, you're going to have basically a strong preference for the now. But then if you push things into the future between, for example, $100 in like 3 months versus $120 in 3 months and a week, you're going to prefer the 3 months and a week with a slightly higher value. And these sort of reversals of preferences occur with this hyperbolic discounting. And so there's been some ideas in sort of more foraging literature about this thing, about thinking about how animals sort of decide between different options. But then there's also been some very interesting work in machine learning, bringing these ideas into reinforcement learning agents and showing that agents that can sort of leverage this idea of multiple timescale, so hyperbolic discounting, can basically perform better than agents that don't. And the key idea behind some of this work is that one way to create multiple, like this sort of hyperbolic discounting that is non-exponential, is to have multiple timescales that you can combine together. So say you have one part of the agent, you know, one part of you that's thinking at a really short term, another part that's thinking of a really long term, and you sort of combine them together. And you average them or you sum them in a certain way. And by doing that, you're going to be able to sort of weigh the short term versus weighing the long term. And so that's what we went to look for essentially in the brain, whether these neurons that we knew were doing this sort of prediction error, whether some of the variability across the neurons, because they're not doing exactly the same thing, could be understood as exactly that idea that they're doing the prediction error, but they're sort of thinking about the timescale of value of rewards at different timescales, basically. And that's exactly what sort of what we found.
So you found that there was, yeah, different time scales, but also that you've found a way to shed more light on exactly when the brain provides those rewards, correct? Tell me a little bit more about, I guess, why that's important to understand, is how the brain processes these rewards and furthering our knowledge of that. That's a very sort of rambling question from me, but
but this is exactly, so it's very important. So exactly, it's this idea of the prediction of the reward. So what we have in the experiment is this exactly sort of what I was asking you earlier, which like we tell the mouse, like, okay, now it's a trial and now you're going to have an odor, and the odor is going to tell you how long you have to wait for the reward. But the prediction error, and that's why it's, again, it's not a direct reward signal, it's a prediction error. This prediction error occurs at the time of the cue. As soon as you know reward is coming in the future, right, suddenly the state is valuable because there's reward coming. But if I tell you the reward is coming in like 1 second, it's more valuable than if I tell you the reward is coming in 5 seconds. Right. And so that's exactly what we did. We shown these offers of different delays, and then we can see that this prediction error, this sort of reward anticipation signal, right? So prediction error at the anticipating the reward scales basically with the delay, right? And so you can literally measure for each neuron the discount function, just like if you ask someone, you know, do you prefer like different amounts of money at different delays? There we sort of give a delay and we see how much the response reduces at the time of the offer when we tell them how long they're going to wait. So it's quite a few seconds sometimes before they actually get the reward, right? We look at the response when we tell them how long they're going to have to wait. And so we can use that and measure basically how they devalue the future. And we can do that for each neuron because we identify individual neurons. And so we can see that the different neurons are doing it with different scales. So some neurons are going to really only respond strongly if the reward is coming within the next second. And other neurons are going to respond strongly as well for rewards coming 3, 4, 5 seconds later. And so you have this sort of diversity of estimations, right? And so you can think that's part of the system is sort of, you know, more like future facing, and the other one is really in the present, really only thinking about the immediate sort of rewards. Does that make sense in terms of that's the type of encoding we saw basically, is when the cue, when you learn about the reward coming in the future, you see a response right at that time, but that response is basically scaled by how far the reward is into the future.
Yeah, I'd wanted to ask about how this furthers our understanding of how individuals act, and by having an algorithm and a measure of as to how the brain's reward system works and how anticipation and motivation works, how that can be applied in the future. But, you know, why do you see this as so significant?
So in general, you know, the sort of this dopaminergic neuron in the midbrain projecting to striatum have been studied a lot because they're involved in a lot of sort of, you know, pathologies and disorders. So, for example, it's not exactly the neurons we studied in our study, but in Parkinson's disease, it's also dopaminergic neurons. But instead of projecting to an area that is sort of more related to cognitive function, they project to an area that's related to more motor function. Right? In the striatum, it's a part of the brain that's more motor related. But it's the same, I want to say, architecture, the same types of neurons, roughly. So some of the ideas we see for reward might happen there. But the neurons we're looking at are very much involved in sort of addictive behaviors and things like that, right? If you dysregulate dopamine, you will see huge changes in behavior. And so you can think, right, this is, again, very speculative, but now you can think that you have, again, this idea of like different neurons have different timescales. If you like overemphasize one timescale or overemphasize another timescale, you could see how behavior would change, right? If now you're not able to learn about long timescales, you cannot make predictions about errors at long timescales, you're essentially going to become sort of very impulsive because you can only do short-term predictions, right? The opposite, if now you only have long timescales, you're not going to be able to do any short timescale predictions, and you're going to have this sort of only far-reaching, but potentially disconnected with the immediate present. And that's what's interesting is that, you know, again, all of this is quite speculative, but if we can go back to the single neuron, right? Like the idea for us that we measured single neurons and they have this property that seem conserved across tasks, you can really see as a mechanism what would shift the balance one way or the other. It could be pretty low level changes at the level of single neurons across the neurons that push the it's a distribution, but you push the distribution one way or the other, and it could create basically an imbalance one way or the other. So that's the sort of stuff we could study a bit more precisely in animals, where we could manipulate these things. But it is very much like an appealing hypothesis that this could lead to some of the changes we see in behavior, whether it's, I want to say, pathological or not, right? Like just some people are more impulsive than others. It's not necessarily pathology, but perhaps it could be rooted in these sort of things, or at least part of it could be rooted in this.
Paul Massett is a behavioral neuroscientist at McGill University. His team's research is published in the journal Nature. I'm Lucas Willard. Now, we travel to Lake George in northern New York, where WAMC Northeast Public Radio's Southern Adirondack Bureau Chief Aaron Shello Levine boarded a floating classroom.
Two dozen third graders from the Hartford Central School District in New York are packing onto a Lake George Association boat and fastening their life jackets. The boat doubles as a so-called floating classroom, and materials for a number of experiments are stored all over the boat. The classroom arrives at a quiet, relatively calm cove along Lake George's eastern shore. Students drop modified measuring tapes into the water to gauge the lake's cloudiness, also known as turbidity.
You have to instill in these kids at a young age the importance of not just protecting Lake George, but every water body, stream, pond, lake, everything that they care about. These are the kids that are going to be dealing with environmental issues, certainly at probably a more progressed rate because of climate change.
Lindsay Kenna is the LGA's Education for Action Manager. The association oversees the maintenance of the lake in collaboration with organizations like the Lake George Park Commission. It also runs annual shore cleanups. While federal spending cuts under the Trump administration have threatened some of the LGA's operations, Kenna says the floating classroom is here to stay.
One of our main grants for the boat is federally funded, so we are, you know, we're concerned, but we're not letting that stop us. We are actively seeking other grants, and moving forward, if that funding is to go away, we will seek other funding sources out in the future. We're very fortunate. We have a lot of support here on Lake George. You know, our federal funding is quite minimal compared to every other funding source that we have.
While the pandemic caused a dip in the number of students taking tours on the boat, Kenna says the floating classroom now hosts upwards of 2,000 students annually, instilling the next generation with an appreciation of the 32-mile-long lake is especially important, as a changing planet could threaten its long-term viability. According to the LGA, over the past 40 years, the temperature of the top 10 meters of water in the lake has risen by 2.5 degrees. Over that same time period, the concentration of chlorophyll A, the green pigment in algae the LGA tracks to monitor algal blooms, has increased by 29%. In 2020, the lake experienced its first confirmed harmful algal bloom. So, the association says it's vital that more people are invested in protecting the sparkling Adirondack gem. Next up, students dunk handheld trawls to capture the critters that form the lake's ecosystem. Kyson Hammond and Mason Monren are hard at work.
So what are you guys doing right now? Talk to me.
We're trying to catch the zooplankton. Pull it up, man. Freaking out.
Go down.
Yeah, just that, man.
Oh! The two take their captured lake water to one of several microscopes.
Make a big drop.
There's a big one.
No, I can do it. I can do it.
There's a big one.
Yep.
He's right there.
Watch out.
Okay. Alright, so what, can you describe to me what you're seeing in there?
There are like little green planktons, and they're moving.
What do they look like?
We got a huge
little green things.
Apart from learning how to catch and identify various plankton, students learn the roles those organisms play in the local ecosystem. Teacher Victoria Vanier says her students get way more out of the annual boat trip than just an afternoon out of the classroom.
One of the reasons why we keep coming back here to the Lake George floating classroom, because the kids really love it, and they learn about the environment, they learn about the health of the lake and why it's so important for them, even not just Lake George, but any water source.
Ellen Weatherby has been running classes on the boat for 3 years, but she's been around the lake her whole life. It means the world to her that she gets to share her passion for the Queen of American Lakes.
One of the most impressionable things for me was a whole thing in sixth grade about pollution. And that's one of the things I tell them, is that it's not just this lake, it's any body of water, any place that you feel you want to protect, it's important. And I think it is important at this young an age, because obviously it made an impression on me when I was in sixth grade. So, you know, I get that. They're very impressionable at this point.
Reporting for the Southern Adirondack Bureau on the campus of Skidmore College, I'm Aaron Shuttle-Levine for WAMC News.
This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1812. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.